Have you ever found yourself in, well, basically this exact scenario? Your lead designer pings you and asks if you can, just enlarge a call to action button on the homepage.
Oh, yeah, a classic request.
Right. They just want the text a tiny bit more noticeable, to drive up the click-through rate. And you think, I can do that in my sleep.
Absolutely.
So you bump up the CSS padding, you submit a pull request, someone glances at it, approves it, and it goes live.
Pretty much a standard Tuesday for, well, a lot of front-end developers out there.
Yeah, exactly. But then Wednesday morning rolls around, and you get this panicked message that your tiny little CSS tweak on the homepage somehow cascaded and completely broke the layout on a totally unrelated product page.
Oh, the worst feeling.
It is. The
No.
add to cart buttons are overlapping the product images, and they are, I mean, they're completely unclickable. You essentially broke the store,
Yeah.
and suddenly you're hit with this lingering, just sinking lack of confidence in your own code. Like, you become terrified to touch anything at all.
You are describing the exact anxiety of developing without a safety net. It's actually a scenario pulled straight from PJC Anders Forward to the book we are looking at today.
Yeah, it really set the stage for me.
It perfectly encapsulates why we are having this conversation, you
It
know?
really does. Because Summer's book, Front End Testing Guide, Strategies and Practices, is basically a survival manual for that exact feeling.
A very much needed one.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive is to give you the ultimate shortcut to being a well-informed, confident developer. We're going to extract the absolute best insights from this guide, break down the often misunderstood testing pyramid, and give you the tools to write tests that actually save you time.
Rather than creating some massive, brittle maintenance nightmare.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. And I think we should start with the very foundation of that pyramid, which is unit tests.
Yeah, that makes sense. Eddie Gao, in his foreword to the book, provides a brilliant way to think about this foundation. He uses this Lego
Oh,
analogy.
I loved that part.
Yeah, it's great. If you are building a massive Lego castle, you have to know that every single individual block is structurally sound before you start snapping them together.
Right.
That is the essence of unit testing. You are isolating the absolute smallest fragments of your code, usually individual functions, to guarantee they produce the expected output for a given input.
And the book points out why this level of isolation is critical, even for things that seem, incredibly simple. There was this wild example about basic
Well,
math.
the JavaScript math quirk.
Yes. If you write a JavaScript function to add two numbers and you pass it 0.1 and 0.2,
Any rational human being expects 0.3.
exactly. But JavaScript handles floating point numbers by converting them to binary fractions. And because of how that conversion works behind the scenes, you don't get 0.3. You get 0.3000000000004.
Which is just, I mean, it's wild to look at.
It's insane. But if you extrapolate that out to an e-commerce platform, a tiny rounding error like that, multiplied over thousands of transactions.
It could literally cost a company serious money before anyone even notices the discrepancy.
Right, which highlights the core utility of the unit test, I think. It catches that bizarre edge case in milliseconds, long before the code is ever deployed.
Precisely. It forces the developer to pause, recognize the floating point issue, and apply a method like, say, to fixed to round the decimal properly.
The Lego block is fixed before it ever touches the castle.
Exactly. But the book also stresses that for a unit test to work, the function has to follow the minimal scope principle.
Meaning it has to do exactly one thing, right?
Yes. If you write a massive utility function that calculates currency, fetches the current time from an API, and updates a user's database record all simultaneously,
Sounds like a nightmare to test.
you cannot write a reliable unit test for it. There are just too many variables. You are forced to break that monolith down into three separate testable Lego blocks.
Okay, so testing basic math functions is one thing. That's easy enough to wrap your head around. But testing actual UI components, like in React, for example, is where I think people really start to get
Yeah,
lost.
that's where the waters get a bit muddy.
Let me throw a scenario at you to see if I'm understanding the book's warning about this. Let's say I have a React component. It's just a simple counter.
Okay.
It has a button, and when you click it, the number goes up. If I write a test that simulates a click and then checks if my internal component state variable changes from 0 to 1, isn't that enough? I mean, why does the book call that fragile?
Because that test is falling headfirst into the behavior versus implementation trap.
Okay.
You aren't testing what the component actually does for the user. You are testing how the developer wrote the code to achieve it.
I think I see where this is going. If I decide to refactor that code, let's say it was written, I don't know, 3 years ago as a class component, and I want to update it to a modern functional component using hooks.
Right, the underlying logic is completely gutted and replaced. The whole concept of this dot state dot count doesn't even exist anymore.
So my test, which was explicitly looking for that internal state variable, is going to fail and scream at me, even though the button on the screen still works perfectly for the user.
Exactly.
My test is broken, but my app is fine. That's the tight coupling problem.
You've nailed it. Your test was coupled to the implementation. The book argues forcefully that we must test behavior.
Not the internal wiring.
Right. Instead of probing the internal state, your test should simulate the click and then look at the actual rendered DOM. Does the text displayed on the screen change to one?
Oh, wow.
If you test the outward behavior, your test becomes invincible to refactoring. You can rewrite the internal logic 10 times over, and as long as the user experience remains intact, the test stays green.
That is a huge mindset shift. Okay, so we've got our individual Lego blocks working perfectly. We know the math functions work. We know the components render. But wait, if I just prove my add to cart button works in isolation, and I prove my shopping cart component works in isolation,
You still have a blind spot.
right. I still don't actually know if clicking the button puts the item I in the cart. The blocks work, but the bridge between them might be completely broken. Is that where we move up the pyramid?
That is precisely the domain of integration testing. You are verifying the communication pathways.
Okay.
The book illustrates this with an image gallery feature. You have a parent component called ImageList. Its job is to fetch data from a server and pass that data down to a child component called ImageItem, which actually displays the picture and the
And
text.
if a new developer joins the team, goes into the image item code, and decides to rename a property from, let's say, title to heading.
The isolated unit test for ImageItem will still pass. It says, "Give me a heading and I will render it."
But the actual application is broken because the parent image list doesn't know about the change. It is still trying to pass down a property called title.
Exactly. The integration test catches that miscommunication because it renders both of them together. But the book brings up a really thorny issue here with how people write these tests, which is mocking.
Oh, yeah, mocking. It's kind of like if you're rehearsing a play and you replace the lead actor with a cardboard cutout.
That's a great way to put it.
Sure, the supporting actors can say their lines to the cardboard and the director can check off that the cues happened.
Right.
But you have zero idea if there's actual chemistry or if the real lead actor is going to trip over a prop on opening night.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it, and the book takes a very hard stance here. Maximize realism.
Okay.
When developers rely on excessive mocking, like replacing child components with fake versions just to make the test run faster or simpler, they are essentially creating an alternate universe. You are now forced to maintain the real code, and you are forced to maintain the cardboard cutout.
And if you update the real child component, but you forget to update the mock version in your test suite,
It happens all the
your
time.
test is literally lying to you. It's passing, giving you a false sense of security, while the actual bridge between components is completely burned.
What's fascinating here is how the author pushes back against the traditional instinct to mock everything. The advice is to render components fully in your integration tests. Let them interact organically.
Let them pass real data back and forth. So,
Exactly.
does the book say we should never mock anything? Because, like, if my app connects to Stripe to process credit cards, I obviously don't want my automated test charging a real credit card 1,000 times a day.
Right. That is the pragmatic compromise. You mock external boundaries, third-party APIs, payment gateways, complex back-end databases that you don't control.
Things outside the ecosystem.
You intercept those network requests so you aren't reliant on an external server. But for your own internal components, the ones you wrote and control, let them talk to each other for real.
Okay, so we've tested the blocks and we've verified the bridges connecting them. But even with all of that, we still don't know what the user actually experiences when they open a browser.
Which naturally moves us to the very top of the testing pyramid.
End-to-end testing, or E2E, and visual testing.
This is where we validate the entire ecosystem. The book uses a photo upload application called Memory as its case study. With an E2E framework like Cypress, you aren't just checking code in a vacuum. Cypress physically spins up a real browser instance.
Yeah, it's like programming a ghost user.
It really is.
You write a script that tells the browser, hey, navigate to the URL, find the input field, type in a user's name, locate a file on the hard drive, upload a valid JPEG, click the submit button, and then scan the screen to ensure the green success banner appears.
Exactly.
And you can write the inverse, too. Upload a massive PDF and ensure the app correctly rejects it and displays a red error message.
Right. It proves that your front-end interface, your network layer, and your back-end database are all perfectly synchronized.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. E2E is incredible for functional workflows, but it is entirely blind to aesthetics.
Oh, completely.
An E2E test can tell you that the submit button exists in the DOM and that clicking it fires the right function. But it cannot tell you if a recent CSS change made the button transparent.
Or if it accidentally floated off the right side of the screen where a human could never actually click it.
Yes, which is the blind spot visual testing was invented to solve.
Exactly.
I remember using old school DOM snapshots years ago. The testing tool would just save a giant text file of your raw HTML structure. And they were, frankly, a nightmare.
They were so brittle.
Right. Because if you just added an invisible div simply to group some elements together for a Flexbox layout, the test would fail because the text file changed. It was exhausting.
The modern approach the book advocates for uses tools like Percy or Chromatic. Instead of comparing text strings of HTML, they spin up headless browsers across different screen sizes, mobile, tablet, desktop, and take literal pixel-perfect screenshots of the rendered UI.
That makes so much more sense.
Then they layer the new screenshot over the baseline screenshot and use algorithms to highlight the exact visual differences, or diffs.
The localization example in the book perfectly illustrates why this is non-negotiable. Summer describes a dessert shop website. In the original Chinese layout, everything is compact and gorgeous. But when they localize the site to English, one of the menu items translated to fig strawberry matcha cake.
A very long string of characters.
A very long string. And because it was so physically long, it completely broke out of its container and smashed right into the pricing information.
Yikes.
An E2E test wouldn't catch that because the text, fig strawberry matcha cake, is technically present in the code. The functionality is there. But a visual test instantly flags the broken layout.
Now let's explore a very common pushback developers have when they reach this point in the pyramid.
Okay, hit me.
If E2E and visual testing cover exactly what the user actually experiences in reality, why bother with the bottom of the pyramid at all? Why not just delete the unit and integration tests and rely entirely on Cypress and Percy?
I mean, I get that logic. It sounds appealing. If the user can check out the app works, why test the individual math functions?
It comes down to cost, speed, and the absolute nightmare of debugging. E2E tests are incredibly slow. They have to wait for the browser to open, wait for network requests, wait for animations to finish.
Right. They take real-world time.
A suite of unit tests can run thousands of checks in 2 seconds. A suite of E2E tests might take 45 minutes.
Wow. And if an E2E test fails, I guess it just tells you the user couldn't check out.
Exactly. You are left staring at a failed checkout flow, and you have to dig through megabytes of server logs and network traces just to discover that the root cause was a simple floating point math error in a utility function.
The 0.1 plus 0.2 problem we discussed earlier.
Exactly. If you have the full pyramid, your unit test fails instantly and points to the exact line of code. You need a wide base of fast, cheap unit tests supported by a narrow peak of slower, highly realistic E2E tests.
That makes perfect sense. But let's talk about maintenance, because having a beautiful pyramid is completely useless if it constantly crumbles. Why do these tests randomly break just because a designer wanted to tweak the font or adjust the layout?
That is usually the fragility of element selectors. When you write a test, you have to tell the testing framework how to find the button you want to click.
And relying on CSS class names is incredibly common. Saying, click the button with the class blue button.
Very common, but very dangerous.
It's kind of like if I tell you to go find my friend in a crowded mall, and I say, she's the one with bright red hair.
Okay.
If she went to a salon yesterday and dyed it blonde, you will walk right past her. You'll never find her. The actual person didn't change at all, just her styling.
And that is exactly what a CSS selector does to an automated test. A developer realizes that a button isn't blue anymore, so they change the class name from blue button to primary action just to keep the CSS clean.
And suddenly your entire test suite goes red. The test fails,
yep.
Even though the button functions perfectly. So if CSS classes are too fragile because styling changes constantly, do we have to start hard coding HTML IDs?
Yeah.
Because that feels like it would create a massive conflict with the actual structure of the document, especially if we have like multiple similar components on a page.
The elegant solution the book strongly advocates for is the data test date attribute. You add a custom attribute to your HTML elements, specifically for testing. Something like data test date equals checkout submit button.
And you configure Cypress or Jest to completely ignore CSS, ignore HTML tags, and only look for that specific data attribute.
You are creating a firewall between your design and your testing logic. A designer can change the element from a button to a stylized div. They can swap out the CSS framework entirely. But as long as that data test date remains intact, the test will find it and execute perfectly.
Okay, that solves the CSS nightmare.
Yeah.
But what about the absolute worst pain point in testing, which is the flaky test?
Oh, the flaky test.
The test that passes on Monday fails on Tuesday and passes again on Wednesday, and literally nobody touched the code base.
It makes you want to pull your hair out. Flaky tests are toxic because they destroy a team's trust in the testing suite. If tests fail randomly, developers just start ignoring the red alerts entirely. The book gives a textbook example of this with a function called check Valentine's Day.
Yeah, it's a simple function. If the system's current date is February 14th, it returns a string saying Happy Valentine's Day. If it's any other day of the year, it returns full. Today is not Valentine's Day.
So consider what happens when a developer writes a test expecting the output Happy Valentine's Day. They write it on February 14th, the test passes beautifully, they commit the code.
And the automated server runs that exact same test the next morning on February 15th, and it fails. Because the underlying system clock moved forward. The test is relying on a variable outside of its control.
We call that a resource dependency. The test isn't isolated. To fix a flaky test, you have to sever that dependency. In this case, use a mocking tool. Jest has a built-in feature called use fake timers.
Oh, nice.
You inject a command that tells the testing environment freeze time. For the duration of this test, the date is permanently February 14th.
That is so smart.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, tests must be completely deterministic. If you feed a test the exact same inputs, it must yield the exact same outputs 100% of the time, regardless of the real-world date, time, network speed, or server load.
Determinism is the only way to build trust. And I guess that also applies to the order in which tests run. The book highlights how state bleed causes flakiness.
Yes.
Imagine test A clicks a button that increments a global counter from 0 to 1. Test B is written to verify that the initial state of the counter is 0.
If test B happens to run after test A, it fails because the counter is already at 1.
Right, it bled over.
Which is why testing frameworks provide before each and after each hooks. You use these functions to rigorously reset your application state. Before every single test runs, you wipe the database, clear the local storage, and reset the counters to 0. Every test must execute in a pristine, isolated vacuum.
Now we have unbreakable, deterministic tests. But how do we actually know when we are done? How do we know we've written enough tests? And honestly, nobody wants to spend 80% of their week just writing test syntax.
That leads us to the metrics developers use, primarily code coverage. The idea is that the testing tool tracks what percentage of your actual lines of code were executed while the tests ran.
But the book warns that treating code coverage as the ultimate goal is a trap. There is an example of a count component where the developer hit 77% code coverage. It sounds like a solid B+.
Sure does.
But when you look closer, the test only ever clicked the increment button. It completely missed the function that decrements the counter. And the book takes it a step further. It says even 100% code coverage is a dangerous illusion.
Think about the mechanics of code coverage. 100% just means the compiler touched every line of code at least once. It does not mean you tested every human scenario.
That's a huge distinction. Yeah.
Consider a function that takes two numbers from a user and divides them. Your test feeds it 10 and 2. The function executes the division line, returns 5, and the test passes. You have 100% code coverage for that function.
But you didn't write a test to see what happens when the user types in a 0. The line of code was executed, but the critical edge case was completely ignored. It would completely crash the app in production.
Which is why the author champions use case coverage over line coverage. You shouldn't blindly chase a 100% vanity metric. Instead, you should use the covered report as an investigative tool.
Oh, I see.
Look at the lines of code that aren't covered and use them as clues to deduce which user workflows or edge cases you haven't thought of yet.
So what does this all mean for our daily workflow? Because manually writing tests for every conceivable human use case sounds like an agonizingly slow process.
It was. But the final chapter of the book introduces a profound paradigm shift, which is utilizing AI to bridge the gap between human logic and testing syntax.
This part blew my mind, because it doesn't just say, ask ChatGPT to write your tests, which, let's be honest, usually results in garbage code anyway.
Yeah, that rarely works well.
It introduces a specific workflow using a tool called Mermaid.
Mermaid is a Markdown-based tool that allows you to draw flow charts simply by typing text. You create a visual map. Node A points to Node B. User clicks login points to System Checks Credentials, which branches into success or error.
You are literally mapping out the human behavioral logic. And then you feed that Mermaid flowchart into an LLM like ChatGPT and instruct it to use that map to generate the foundational Cypress or Jest test code.
The reason this is so effective is that large language models are phenomenal at generating syntax, but they are terrible at guessing your business logic.
Right.
By providing the Mermaid flowchart, you give the AI the exact behavioral map it needs.
And it forces you, the developer, to slow down and understand the user journey perfectly before you ever open your code editor. You cannot draw an accurate flowchart if you don't actually know how the application is supposed to work.
It shifts the developer's cognitive load entirely. Instead of fighting with the syntax of a testing framework, you focus deeply on understanding the product requirements. You handle the logic, and the AI handles the boilerplate.
This has been an incredible journey through the realities of front-end testing. We started by building confidence with unit tests, ensuring our isolated Legos work by testing their behavior, not their internal fragile implementation. We snap them together with integration tests, insisting on maximum realism and keeping our cardboard cutout mocks to an absolute minimum.
We validated the final user journey with end-to-end and visual testing, ensuring that lengthy translations don't destroy the layout.
And we bulletproofed the entire suite using data test state to survive CSS changes, mocked our dependencies to cure flaky tests, and shifted our focus from vanity code coverage to actual use case coverage, all while leveraging AI to accelerate the syntax generation. Implementing these strategies turns testing from a dreaded, mind-numbing chore into a powerful, automated safety net.
It really does.
It prevents those late-night panic attacks when you realize a tiny tweak broke the entire checkout page. You can actually ship your code with total confidence.
The peace of mind is invaluable. And as we wrap up this deep dive, this integration of AI raises an important question for you to mull over. If an LLM can flawlessly write the underlying test syntax based solely on a flowchart of human behavior, does that mean the future of front-end engineering is going to be less about memorizing how to write code and entirely about knowing how to deeply map and understand human intention?